Thomas Merton, the Trappist monk, in his book Conjectures of a Guilty Bystander, says the basic sin of Christianity is to choose oneself over the other, to declare for oneself and not for the other. And what he means is the way in which we place ourselves at the center, the way in which what we believe, what we do, how we live our lives is what we perceive to be ordained by God. That we are self-validating. And that we come to God only to have the life that we have lived affirmed. It's turning the whole thing upside down, where we shape our theology and our psychology to support the life we're already living, as opposed to taking the word of God and changing the way we live. And for Merton, nothing could be farther from the teachings of Jesus. In this morning's gospel, we have James and John shown in a not very flattering light. James and John, you remember, they are the fishermen. They are the ones who Jesus calls when they are working with their father, and they're mending their nets with the hired men. And Jesus comes along and they follow the call. And they leave their nets and they leave their father. So we know a little bit about them. They're sort of in the inner circle. We know, for instance, that they were fairly prosperous. They had a little fishing business going on. They might be what you'd call the Galilean middle class. But in today's gospel, they're shown to be naive, blindly ambitious. They come to Jesus and say, "Teacher, do for us whatever we ask." It's like they've never heard a story in their life. You know, who asks these kinds of questions? How does it come out, right? Do for us whatever we ask. It kind of reminds me of that scene a few chapters earlier at Herod's birthday party. Remember, he's having his cronies and courtiers all together at his birthday party, and his daughter comes and dances for him. And he's so pleased, he says to her, "Ask me whatever you want, and I will give it to you, even up to half my kingdom." She goes on to ask for the head of John the Baptist at the head of her mother. We all know how that turns out rather badly for all of them. But here we have, once again, James and John making this request. Do for us whatever we ask. And Jesus is not the kind of king that Herod is and says, "What is it you want me to do?" And they said, "Well, we'd like to sit at your right and left when you come into your glory." They've kind of got this image of Jesus sitting on a throne and then maybe a little bit lower, each of them sitting on a slightly lower throne at his right and left. And then maybe some of the other apostles sort of fanning out from there, you know. And they're all standing in judgment over the 12 tribes of Israel. They're thinking ahead, you know. They're planning for their future. Because they know how kingship works. Who has the king's ear? Those who sit at the right and the left. And Jesus says back to them, "You don't know what you're asking for." Isn't that the truth? How very often do we not know what we're asking for? We know what we want. But it's not what we get. We are ever looking to be fulfilled, ever looking to be satisfied. And yet there's that strange thing of just when you get what you think you want, either it's not quite what you wanted after all, or even worse, you discover that in fact there's something else further that would be even more fulfilling, even more satisfying. And the whole thing starts all over again. Ever living in anticipation for that time when we will be satisfied. This is our craving ego, ever in search of validation, ever needing more. And it's just, not just material things, and it's really not just about this moment in time. I know, we live in the 21st century Bay Area, everything's at our fingertips, a couple of clicks, Amazon, whoop, right over, there it is. You can get it instantly. You know, it's almost like Amazon could make this their motto, giving you whatever you want. But I was looking at Democracy in America, the Alex de Tocqueville novel, or it's actually a study of America in 1830. Right? He's the Frenchman who comes over to study America, and he writes about the government and how it works, like this is what democracy is, and he's doing that whole thing. And in the second half, he's talking about what are Americans like? What is it like to be in America? And in a chapter titled, Why Americans Are So Restless in Their Pleasures, he says, you know, I have met the most well-educated men, the most purposeful, the most in the best possible setting of any in the world, and yet they seem serious. Their brows are furrowed. They seem even sad in their pleasures. They are ever thinking about what they don't have. And with what they do, they are suspicious that perhaps they have not gotten it in the easiest and most expeditious possible way. 1830. How little has changed. How almost sad in our pleasures that no matter what we are doing, we can imagine and often do some greater pleasure to be had. Some better set of circumstances. This is a very real spiritual illness. This is the craving ego. And so Jesus turns to them and says, you don't know what you're asking for. Can you drink the cup that I drink? Can you be baptized in the baptism that I am baptized in? We're able. Sure. We can do that. They don't seem to give it a thought. They don't seem to detect any of the ominousness that seems to be just jumping out of the text, right? It's like the cup and the baptism. This might not be what we had anticipated, right? I mean, we immediately jump to, Lord, let this cup pass from my lips, you know, Gethsemane. We think baptism by fire. We think bad things coming down the pike. I mean, Jesus has just, for the third time, predicted his betrayal, trial, and death. We're able. And Jesus says, then you will drink the cup, and you will be baptized. But to sit at my right and my left is not mine to give, for it is for those for whom it has been prepared. It's an interesting moment of Jesus in a humble relationship with the Father. This is not John's Jesus, right? It's not mine to give. So now they're getting the cup and the baptism and no thrones, right? And it seems almost like they've stepped in it, right? Oh, bad, you know, you've gotten it, right? And now the other 10, who I have to think may have had their own angle on the seating arrangement of the afterlife, are thinking they've blown it now. And they're mad with them because they've tried to get the best seats, and they begin to quarrel among themselves. And Jesus calls them together and says, it cannot be this way with you. If you want to be first, you must be last. If you want to lead, you must serve. If you want to have glory, you must be slave of all. Honestly, Jesus is not trying to trick them. He is not offering them a bad deal. I think this is very much in keeping with the story from last week, where the man comes forward to be validated for his the way he's living his life. And Jesus says, go and sell all your possessions. And it says he acts out of love, and the man goes away sad. This is the same thing. You don't know what you're asking for. But there is a way out of this living, a way out of always seeking for the self. And that is a life built on serving others. You must give up yourself, this preeminence, this ever hungry need. And if you base your life on service to others and service to God, you will be free. For I have come not to be served, but to serve, and to lay down my life as a ransom for others. This is a way out. This is a teaching that is in all four of the Gospels. This idea of servanthood. In John's Gospel, this is the central teaching of the Last Supper. Jesus puts on the towel, washes the apostles' feet. I have washed your feet, and you call me teacher. You must do this for one another. The answer that he gives them, teacher, do whatever we ask of you, is pupil, go and do for others whatever they ask of you. And you'll have what you want, what you're looking for. We're in that season of the year when we talk about pledge, right? We talk about the ways in which we dispose of our resources. Our money, our time, our attention, and our talents. And of course, it is always about what we're going to pledge and how that sustains all the work here, along with everything else we all do to make this happen. But it is our tradition here in this parish to also make this a time to think broadly about the big picture of our life. To what do I give my precious time and my attention and my money? Honestly, what do you spend your time thinking about? If you're like me, you're always the center of the story. It's always thoughts about me and the future and what's to come. How often do I spend time thinking about someone else really? As though they were myself. Where does my money go, really? And my talents? And the resource that's really the most limited, our time. To what do I give that? And how in keeping with this message is my time, talent, and resources? And every year in the fall, we think about this in light of how we've lived this last year, which is to say, is how I've lived this last year, what I've given my time and money to, still a sufficient representation of how I want to live? How have I been transformed in this church and at this table and in my relationships in ways conscious and unconscious that now make me think differently about this? And so this is an opportunity to realign your life. We receive the teaching just as James and John do. They're just like us. And we know for James and John that it's a transformative message. It can't have been easy to follow Jesus around with these constant, you know, correction of what you think is right. The way you live in your life, the answers you're giving are constantly being corrected, right? It's not just sleeping on the streets and following this guy around. It's that you, those closest, are constantly getting it wrong. It's hard on your ego. And yet they stick around. They stick around because there's something about this message that's transformative. that truly is changing their life. And we know for them that they go on to be leaders. James is the first apostle martyred. He is killed by Herod Agrippa in 44 AD for his faith. Peter is the other apostle we know is martyred. But for the other 10, we don't really know their story. We don't believe that they're actually martyred. And certainly John, we know, travels with Peter and teaches with him and is counted among the leadership of the Jerusalem church. But we don't know that John is martyred. And yet they drink the cup and they receive the baptism, which is to say, they go on to live their lives for others. It's about someone else. It's why we're here. Their choice directly feeds into why we're here. Because when there was so few, their choices were especially consequential. But we are faced with those same choices now for us. In what way are we going to transform our lives? Are we going to let go of our ever-craving ego self, the one that's never satisfied, you know, the one who's always looking for more of what it doesn't need? It's almost like an addiction, and it's very, very cunning. You know, even the quest to give up the self can become one more self-validating process, right? I'm an even better servant than everybody else. You know, I should be recognized and praised for how humble I am. You know, but it's oh so much more, you know, stirring around. It's hard. But the answer is this: focusing on the other. The way in which you spend your time, your talent, your thoughts, your attention. Where your attention goes, that's what matters. And if we live lives focused on others, we will in fact find that deep connection to God and other people that is at the root of our true self, because we're all united in the body of Christ. And when you discover that connection, and you live out of that place, all your restlessness, all your longings, all the things you're looking for will find their completion and satisfaction.